From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The labor movement in the United States has long had a complicated history of addressing race and gender. Some of those complexities are encompassed in the history of Black labor in the United States over four centuries. From the time that Africans were enslaved and shipped to Virginia in 1619 to the modern day conditions of Black workers, the story of how African American workers, including especially Black women workers, navigated a tumultuous, racist, and sexist world is a fascinating one with great relevance today. Writing about this history in his new book is my guest, Joe William Trotter Jr. He's the Giant Eagle Professor of History and Social Justice and founder and director of the Center for African American Urban Studies and the Economy at Carnegie Mellon University. He's also the past president of the Labor and Working Class History Association. He now joins me to discuss his newest book, Workers on Arrival, Black Labor in the Making of America. Welcome to the program, Professor Trotter.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So the title, of course, Workers on Arrival, is such an important one. And I'd like for you to just kind of tease that apart as we begin this conversation. Of course, the main reason that Africans were enslaved and brought to the United States was as an enslaved workforce, was there to create the capital that that white settlers based their wealth on, right? And that origin, of course, bears all the relevance to what came after, right?
Exactly. And Workers on Arrival also tries to get us to think critically about the Black urban experience from the beginning of the transatlantic slave trade to North America. Because very often we think of the laboring experience of African Americans as being so predominantly an agricultural experience, and it was, you know, tobacco, rice production, cotton production later, and so on. Those were critical areas of the Black labor force, and in fact, the predominant areas. But in this book, Workers on Arrival, I'm also trying to suggest that African Americans were urban workers from the beginning, not just agricultural workers. And so that when we think about Black urban workers, we should be thinking about the beginnings of the nation as well as the era of the Great Migration. I think that so much attention is given to that dramatic moment when African Americans moved out of the rural South into cities in large numbers during the early 20th century, early to mid 20th century, that it sort of overshadows the idea that Black people were an urban people as well as a rural people from the outset of the slave trade. And so that's what this book is about, not only acknowledging the rural dimensions of Black life, but also centering this story about how Black people were urbanites from the beginning.
And so that urban population was largely the population that had, through various means, won its freedom, working and beginning to enter the labor force at the same time as there was still a significant Black population that remained enslaved, right?
Yes, that's right. The urban population started to rise during the colonial period slowly, and it slowly increased over time. It also was the setting in which you witness what you might call a significant number of enslaved Blacks eventually gaining access to freedom. And so that free Black population that emerged during the period before the Civil War had a very strong urban component to it. And that's why I think that this early urban population has a lot of significance for thinking about the way in which the African American experience would unfold over the later part of the 19th century, and especially during the 20th century, when African Americans actually become a predominantly urban people. And so that the urban population that I'm talking about, before the Civil War, less than 10% of Black people were urban. But between The end of the Civil War and 1970, that shifted dramatically, and especially during the early 20th century was the Great Migration. So by the late 20th century, over 70% of Black people are living in cities and working in cities, and they are the most urbanized sector of the U.S. population. And so the story that I'm telling in Workers on Arrival is trying to help us understand how that happened and the process by which it developed over several centuries, nearly four centuries of time, as you mentioned at the outset of our discussion.
Who was employing Black workers in urban centers in the beginning as the migration was happening? Who were the main employers and what were the main vocations, not just for Black men, but Black women as well? And I really love, by the way, the cover of your book showing Black women workers.
Yes, well, the employers of Blacks, and we have to say the owners of African Americans as enslaved people, were principally a large, you know, significant commercial business interest, but also significant numbers of white artisans were also purchasing slaves to help them deal with their particular trades and helping them to develop their crafts and to become a profitable enterprise. So it's amazing that a significant number of Blacks were actually employed by what could be considered the working class, but skilled working class. And then, of course, other people at the more elite levels of the society, the slave population was spread over several different types of activities. I mean, even churches, newspapers, all kinds of establishments in cities employed these African people as enslaved people and later gradually as free people.
And were these mostly factory jobs? What about the issue of domestic labor, particularly for women workers?
Yes, I'm happy that you're bringing attention to the role of women, because one of the facets of this story that I feel is very important to underscore is that until well after the Civil War, the women dominated the Black urban population. There were more women living and working in cities than there were men in most places. Of course, there were some places like Richmond, Virginia, that had a sort of a large industrial enslaved Black labor force, and men outnumbered women in that city. But very few other cities had more men than women. And so the issue here is that across the period from the colonial era all the way to the end of the Civil War and even beyond, the vast majority of these African Americans were working as what we call general laborers and domestic and household laborers. That was their primary category of work during most of this period. And women were especially important in households of elite families and families that could afford to purchase and enslave people in the domestic capacity. And so they were scattered, you know, in urban households across these units, different individual family households. Lots of Black people were scattered through those households. And later they would only gradually begin to take up independent households outside those families.
So they, but at some point you then had a shift in the way in which Black labor was viewed, right? Tell us what happened when or what it was that led to women workers and men workers in general as well entering the manufacturing sector in the United States. Tensions not just with their employers, but with white workers.
Okay. Well, I think, Sonali, the dynamic of change in the experiences of African Americans is ongoing. One of the most profound changes of the earlier period is that following the Civil War, and between the Civil War and the beginning of the, I'm sorry, between the Revolution, the American Revolutionary War, and the beginning of the Civil War, during that period, there were an estimated 4 million immigrants who came to America. And most of these immigrants were from Ireland and Germany. And that particular massive migration of people had a profound impact on changing some of the character of African-American labor history during the early 19th century to the Civil War. And one of the major impacts this particular migration had was that it began to put pressure on those African-Americans who had gained a modest foothold in the artisan trade. Some of them right after the American Revolution, but some of them even during the colonial period had gradually gained access to trades. And especially in the South, African-Americans gained tremendous access as enslaved people to the skilled craft. But in this early 19th century period, you begin to see a real undercutting of that particular aspect of the Black working class experience. And so that by the beginning of the Civil War, especially in the urban North, a kind of a earlier pattern of Black craft people, you know, brick masons, carpenters, and so on, having jobs, that has started to dissipate. And so that Black people were being pushed more and more into these jobs that were defined as household service, domestic jobs, and general laborers. And in fact, during that period, you can begin to witness African-Americans making statements and observations about what was beginning to happen to their communities and their workers. And they really started to use terms like, we fear that we're becoming a race of domestics or a race of general laborers. And so that they were worried and wanted to begin to think about ways to counter this downward push on their occupational structure.
Was that a sort of a sense of working class sensibility then creeping into the consciousness to see the group as this collective?
Definitely, there was a beginning, a sense of working class, you know, identity, consciousness, and so on, but very strong racial component. I mean, African-American workers were also very race conscious about who they were and as an African people. But their conditions were even more dire than I've sort of outlined. There was not only pressure during the antebellum period, you know, just before the Civil War, not only pressure on the skilled craft, but these Irish and German workers started to press down on some of the most lucrative general labor and domestic service jobs. So that, to give one example, the one that historians talk about a lot, is that the barbering trade had emerged during the period after the American Revolution.
And the barbering trade. Right.
The barbering trade, yeah. As barbers, you know, they were cutting hair and so on. That was an important occupation for Black people, but it was considered by whites a servile occupation, that it was sort of unfitting for independent citizens of the new republic. And so a lot of whites started to exit this barbering trade after the American Revolution and into the early 19th century. And it left a vacuum whereby Black people flooded into that particular occupation, and they gained a pretty decent niche in that area. And so that by the time of the, the second half of the first, quarter of the 19th century, some Blacks were making a pretty decent living at that job. But as the century wore on, by the Civil War, they were feeling pressure and they were being pushed out. For example, Frederick Douglass made the statement that is often quoted in literature on Black workers during the period, that during the earlier period, he said, a white barber would have been considered a curiosity. But that by the 1850s, their poles were everywhere. They were setting up shop. And so that Black workers had to then start to think about ways to not only protect themselves from removal from the artisan trade, but they had to start thinking about ways to hold on to those very bottom-rung jobs that they had become accustomed to.
So let's sort of cut ahead. There's so much to talk about. And of course, I really encourage people to read your book. I want to cut ahead to the Great Depression and the working class tensions between groups, particularly organized labor, and the way in which Black workers were viewed by white workers and how Black workers viewed themselves. Can you give us a history lesson on that?
Yeah, well, the question of Blacks becoming part of the labor movement, the Depression is a kind of moment of change in which the emergence of the Congress of Industrial Organization represented a kind of a beacon of hope to an extent, because it really embraced the idea that in order to succeed, it had to bring Black and white workers into the same labor union. And so that was a great breakthrough in many ways compared to the earlier years. Between the Civil War and the beginning of the Great Depression, the relationship between Blacks and white workers in the organized labor movement was very, very problematic. And there were a few unions that early on started to embrace African Americans. The United Mine Workers Union was one of those. In the 1890s and through the World War years. But in general, that period had produced problematic interactions between Blacks and their white working class counterpart. So that this is the period before the Great Depression in which African Americans were very often compelled to take jobs as strike breakers in order to enter the mainstream industrial sector, so to speak, the manufacturing economy of the nation. That is the most expansive areas of the economy following the Civil War all the way down to the Great Migration. Black people were pretty much locked out of that sector of the economy, and labor unions played a role in that exclusion of Blacks from the industrial sector. And that started to break down during the Great Depression. Tensions continued, conflict continued, but in general, Blacks were becoming part of the United Steelworkers, the meat packing industry, and the United Auto Workers. Blacks were entering what some historians call the House of Labor finally. And although the tensions continued, there was still a great deal of discrimination within, but there was a sense that there was movement forward in terms of seniority to some extent, which would become a problem later. But Black people were trying to eliminate this notion that they should always be the last hired and the first fired. And the union started to play a role in trying to put a floor under the, you know, the Black workers' experience so that they could have some degree of access to jobs moving forward. But I do have to say right away that seniority became an issue itself because it was very often limited only to those departments that Black people occupied. And those departments across the board were at the bottom rungs of the industrial system. In the heavy labor, blast furnace department, or the killing floors, you know, in the meatpacking industry. And so that when they wanted to move up, they couldn't bid on jobs that were in other departments that had a higher level of pay and represented higher skills of work regimen. They could only move within the limited capacity in those bottom rung kinds of jobs. But even the floor of the industrial economy represented a better wage for African Americans compared to the earlier general labor force outside the industrial system. So there was some movement forward, there was some lag, you know, back And that's why African Americans would, in fact, mobilize increasingly to put pressure on the entire structure, the labor union, employers, and the government, particularly during the Second World War. The March on Washington movement was designed to get the government involved in breaking down barriers in industry, because huge numbers of these industries had government contracts and they were dependent on government money. Black people were taxpayers and they were determined that they were going to break that system down and to create more equity for the Black worker.
And I want to get to that part of the history because it's so critical and especially relevant today. But first, how did the women's labor, Black women's labor movement evolve? Did Black women begin to gain a foothold in the more technological sectors or the manufacturing sectors, particularly as there were changes in the political landscape in the United States?
Yeah, well, the Black women's Black women workers, and of course white women workers too, they faced a turbulent period of history. Even during the interwar years, they had a difficult time gaining access to industrial jobs. And not only that, but one of the stories of the 1930s revolves around the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and Maids. That was a union that A. Philip Randolph, a great labor leader, was the forefront, you know, organizer of that union. And that union stayed within the American Federation of Labor, but it put increasing pressure on the Federation to accept the Brotherhood as a full-fledged union. And eventually, the Brotherhood was accepted. But in accepting the Brotherhood, and getting a contract for these Black workers who were these train porters, the Brotherhood accepted a contract that excluded Black women who were also, sort of domestic service workers in the company of these railroads, in the employment of these railroads. And so that they lost out. And in fact, the Brotherhood quietly dropped the maid part from his name, because there was a real understanding that women were not brought in on the ground floor with men in that particular instance. So that's the Great Depression. That's right in the 1935, 37, 38 period. But then during the protests to break open defense industries, Black women had an uphill battle there as well, because some of the protests around getting jobs for African Americans initially, at least not for a long time, but initially focused on African American men especially, and then gradually women protested, including writing letters to Eleanor Roosevelt saying that the movement to desegregate defense industries was not taken seriously the integration of women into those industries. And so there was some protest to get women their grievances before the Fair Employment Practices Committee. They started to lodge their grievances and showing that it wasn't just discrimination by race, but also discrimination by gender, and that the community needed to do more, and the political movements needed to do more to address that issue. And so gradually women did gain some access to industrial jobs, but the equity issue and the fight over integrating women into the full range of jobs, similar to Black men, were not integrated into the full range of jobs right away and until the post-war period, when they started to expand much greater into the skilled sectors of the economy.
So we only have time for one last question, but I'm wondering how critical it was then that all of this history led up to that time, especially during the civil rights movement, where Black workers fought for desegregation. They fought for an end to the discriminatory practices of employers, because as you said earlier, they were taxpaying citizens too. And not only did they have to deal with discrimination in things like housing and the sort of geographical segregation, but also within the workplace and within education and all of these other aspects that were pertinent to their labor and their labor power, right?
Right, exactly. And that becomes part of the story, you know, about the 1970s and the 80s. The big complicating factor, of course, is that at the very time that women started to get access to a broader range of jobs through consent decrees in the steel industry, for example, that was the moment where the overall picture for the manufacturing sector was beginning to really take a downward spiral, and so that there was an increasing loss of manufacturing jobs at the moment that the what you might call the women's movement and the drive to really equalize the gender question started to take shape. And so that we see that there is a way in which, to take one example, in the steel industry, some of the women in the Pittsburgh region talked about how they finally got jobs in the steel industry during the early 1970s. But then by the 1980s, they were among that group of steel workers who were let go and who lost their jobs and who had to really now navigate this new economy. Well, actually navigate the downsizing of the manufacturing economy, and then to figure out how to really reintegrate themselves into a new economy and how to fight the equity issue even as another economy is being forged. So the challenges of the gender issue are just massive and continuing. Mm. Alongside, of course, the racialized dimension of the downturn. I mean, the jobs that African Americans lost and the percentage of Black workers becoming unemployed, those were much higher for Black workers in the midst of this destructive downturn than they were for white workers. And so that Black men and women are going to enter the late 20th century with tremendous challenges. And I talk about some of these in the Workers on Arrival, and to try to connect the African-American story of the earlier years to this new unfolding moment in the late 20th and early 21st century.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and for writing this important contribution to the history of the Black labor movement. Thank you so much, Professor Trotter.
Thank you.
My guest has been Joe William Trotter, Jr., the Giant Eagle Professor of History and Social Justice and founder and director of the Center for African American Urban Studies and the Economy at Carnegie Mellon University. We've been discussing his new book. It's called Workers on Arrival, Black Labor in the Making of America. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.